I'd like you to take those notes and find, now this is not easy to do, session number 4. But I'll tell you how to do it. On the bottom of each page, well, almost every page, with certain exceptions which I could explain, is a footer with a page number. And the session we're looking at right now is called Thursday, Friday. So just find Thursday, Friday of the Passion Week and then go to page 1, the Passion Week of Jesus Christ. That is page, and again, the first page is not paginated, but not got a page number, but page 1 comes directly before page 2, if that's any help. All right, the Passion Week of Jesus Christ. I think I'll come down there for what it's worth. We have been making our way through the events of the Passion, and I'm going to very briefly review. And I think I can do that with this front page. Now, I said yesterday morning that there was an important and unmistakable distinction of emphasis and focus in the early part of Jesus' ministry and the later part. It's going to become important, so let me just say it real quickly. For 2.5 years, and if you're at all interested, at the very back of your notes is a purple sheet with a chart on it. And we looked at this chart on another page, actually. But that sort of summarizes the ministry of Jesus. And in the left-hand vertical boxes that are a little bit shaded, as opposed to shady, there is a distinction made there that is going to become important to what we're going to talk about here this morning on Thursday evening. Does that make any sense? We're going to talk about it this morning, which the subject of which is Thursday evening Passion Week. Because, as I say, in the first couple of years, the first 2.5 years or so of Jesus' ministry, his focus was on public presentation. And during that time, he methodically and carefully, with careful planning and strategy, saturated the land of Israel with the claims concerning himself, that he was Messiah, that he was God come in the flesh. And during those 2.5 years, he went where the Jews were. He went from synagogue to synagogue. He made these claims very carefully, although somewhat in coded fashion, so as not to excite the anger of Rome. And he did many miracles, because the miracles were the way that God vindicated his claim to be a divine messenger. And he desperately needed said vindication because his claims were so radical, so terribly, terribly difficult to believe. That makes sense to you for 2.5 years, but then you have these moments of rejection that we talked about. And as a result, Jesus begins in the last year of his ministry, and I call it there in the chart private preparation. The first 2.5 years I like to think of as public presentation. And the focus in the last year, now these are not watertight distinctions, but the emphasis is certainly there. The last year is better. I think the focus is private preparation. And here's the point, that during that last year, Jesus works very, very hard to confront his disciples. That's why I call it private preparation. He's no longer going to the nation. He's looking for opportunity to get alone with his disciples because he wants to confront them with the reality that he's going to die. And up until almost 3 years into a 3.5 year ministry, Jesus never, ever mentioned his death explicitly. And when he did mention his death, you will recall the disciples were absolutely horrified. And we read a passage in Luke 18 that says, as he was going up to the city of Jerusalem for the Passover at which he would die, he once again took his disciples and said he was going to die, and they refused to hear it. Remember that verse that said they didn't get it? It was hidden from them. They didn't understand the things that were spoken. Now, that's very important because, as I said yesterday, as Jesus moves toward the cross and methodically toward the cross, understanding exactly about what is about to take place, John makes this point so explicitly in John chapter 13. We'll look at it in a moment. As he is moving toward the cross, his disciples are absolutely clueless. And it's my persuasion, and this is perhaps a bit of an inference as opposed to an explicit statement, but it comes very close. Matter of fact, very close. It's my persuasion that the disciples were persuaded, they were convinced that Jesus was about to hand out kingdom assignments and that the kingdom was about to dawn. And Jesus, meanwhile, is moving toward the cross. That makes sense to you? And that's sort of the background of what's unfolding here. Now, on your sheet there, if you go back to page one of session four there, and let me say just a word as you do that about these notes. Most of you have been with me, but I realize these notes are a bit cumbersome, and obviously we're not going to go through them blow by blow. I would encourage you, and make any corrections you want, tear out the pages you don't like, you know what I'm saying? But my hope is that it could be a help to you. And that in your own study, and I tell you something, you are going to find it exciting to actually put together the various pieces of the drama of Jesus' life, and not only Jesus' life as a whole, but of the Passion Week itself, and weave it into a narrative. It's tremendously helpful, I think, because as I said the other night, I think our tendency is to understand this little incident and that incident and so on, but to actually see how it unfolds as a narrative can be helpful. And it's with that intent that these notes were constructed. Now, how successfully, you judge for yourself. But if they can be a help to you, I would be thrilled. But having said that, let me take you to that first page real quickly where I've got the days at the bottom of the week. And I'll just use that outline, as it were, to get us up to Thursday afternoon. Because as I I'm reviewing here, folks, forgive me for those of you who've been with, but several weeks before the Passover comes in the spring of the year. Passover is a pilgrimage feast, and therefore Jews from all over, certainly Israel and beyond, make their way up to the temple for Passover. On the other hand, Jesus, of course, Paul is going to tell us later on, is in fact our Passover, and Jesus is going to die as Passover lamb. And it's my persuasion with regard to chronology that he's going to die at the time of Passover slaying. That is, he is going to die as our lamb on the day of Passover. So at any rate, what I was going to say is that several weeks before Passover, Jesus, who had been in Perea, where he had found safety by reason of crossing over into another Roman officer's jurisdiction, he was in Perea. He heard that his friend Lazarus was sick. He tarried 2 days, came, arrived the fourth day after Lazarus died, and then in what is certainly the most spectacular, and I think the only miracle of Jesus' life, which he contrived to make more spectacular than it might have been. He deliberately waited those 2 days so that by the time he got there, Lazarus was good and dead, if you don't mind. But the point is, it was 4 days. Jesus comes, and in a remarkably, unspeakably spectacular, sensational miracle, he calls Lazarus back from the dead. When he does that, the Jewish leadership determines to put him to death. They convene their council, the Sanhedrin. They say, this man does many miracles. If we leave him alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans will come and take away our place and our nation, and we like our kingdom better than the one he's offering us. There is no form nor comeliness in him that we should desire him. We like what we've got better. And so they determine to put him to death. There is a price on his head. Jesus goes to a little village called Ephraim. About a week or a little more before Passover, Jesus leaves that little village of Ephraim on the border between Samaria and Judea. And Luke 17:11, remember we saw this, would follow in order to get to Jerusalem, avoid Samaritan soil. And he travels with them for some time. Along the way, he's doing miracles. He's teaching his Messiah. And he's got everybody excited. By the way, John says explicitly that as a result of the raising of Lazarus in Jerusalem, everybody was standing around asking the question, is Jesus even going to come up to the feast this year? Everybody is wondering. And so Jesus travels for several days with this band, if you don't mind, of Passover pilgrims. Then he, Jesus, stops in Bethany just outside the Sabbath zone, allows that group of pilgrims to go into the city bearing the twofold message. He is coming. We know he's coming. We've been traveling with him. Everybody's excited. And secondly, because he stopped in Bethany and he can't come in on Shabbat, he'll be here Sunday morning. So Jesus very carefully alerts the city to the fact that he's coming, gives them a day to make preparation so that early on Sunday morning, when Jesus does in fact take that donkey and ride over the crest of the Mount of Olives and down into the city, he's greeted by this mass of people who were throwing down their garments, waving the palm fronds, singing the Hallel Psalms, crying out, "Save us, Hoshna." And that's what I call on your sheet there, Sunday, a day of messianic presentation, because it was on that day that Jesus very carefully and officially, a day which in my persuasion had been explicitly predicted, Daniel chapter 9, verses 24-27, some 600 years earlier, that on this day, and Jesus rides in on a donkey, clearly and deliberately fulfilling Zechariah chapter 9. And so that is the day when Jesus offered himself most officially, most dramatically, to Israel. Had you and I been there on that Sunday, that triumphal entry day, we would have believed the city was going for it. I think we would have been convinced that this was working. Certainly, Jesus' disciples were. They thought, boy, this is great. Look at this. Can you imagine? Well, then Monday, Tuesday on your sheet there, I call days of messianic proclamation. And what I mean by that is this. And let me just tell you real quickly. On Monday, Jesus returned from Bethany and came to the temple and cleansed the temple for the second time in his ministry. When he did that, the first time having been at the first Passover of his ministry some 3 years earlier, when he did that, he, number one, once again, he excited attention to himself. Everybody would have been excited about this. We talked a little bit yesterday, won't go back over it, but there were horrible abuses at the temple and people resented it. But you see, you couldn't go down the street and start, forgive me, this is my background, the Second Baptist Temple, you know what I'm saying? You had to just stay with it. There was only one temple and you couldn't do anything about it. And so people would go up and be made merchandise of and abused by the priests. And when Jesus drove out the money changers and drove out the merchants and made that whip and insisted, "You're not going to make my father's house a den of thieves," he instantly became, once again, the focus of all attention, the hero of all the people who were there. But as I said last night, he galvanized Sadducean and Pharisaic hatred. Now, the Sadducees, who had been dragging their feet because they left him alone for 3 years, they said, "You're right, Pharisees, we need to be rid of him." And so they convene a council to be rid of him. But Jesus not only cleanses the temple, but he possesses it for 2 days. He puts his enemies to silence. In public debate, he defeats them and puts them to silence, and they confess that they have no answer to give him, which is terribly dramatic and humiliating. And then Jesus proves his messiahship out of the Old Testament, from the Scriptures, out of Psalm 110, and speaks these parables of condemnation about the man who had two sons and about the vineyard, the man who had a vineyard and let it out to wicked husband and all those sort of things. And then, on Tuesday afternoon, and this is why I call it days of messianic proclamation, Jesus pronounces these woes upon the Pharisees. And this is where I left you the other night. Matter of fact, I asked this question, given Sunday, why Friday? That is, given the acceptance of Sunday, why is the nation, the same people, folks, the same crowd, why are those same people crying for his crucifixion and insisting, "We will not have this man to reign over us"? This man whom we welcomed as king and begged to be our king on Sunday. On Friday, they're crying out, "We'll not have this man to reign over us." So given Sunday, why Friday? And the answer is Monday and Tuesday. Because on Monday and Tuesday, Jesus carefully put the most unmistakable and unbridgeable distance between himself and the Pharisees. And the Pharisees at that time had become the embodiment of wicked self-righteousness, of the works religion that Paul condemns in Romans 4. And as a result, And those Pharisees were powerful. And if you crossed your Pharisee, he could make your life terribly miserable. And so now Jesus is saying, all right, you make a choice. It's easy on Sunday to throw down your garments. There's a lot of mob spirit going on there, just getting with it. But now I'm asking you one by one, are you willing to build your house on this rock rather than that sand? It's exactly the same thing. Are you willing to follow this narrow way rather than that broad way? And that's Tuesday afternoon. And that's what I mean by messianic proclamation. So let me say it this way. On Sunday, Jesus offers himself to Israel officially, dramatically, sincerely. Just as I believe he offers himself to you and to me, to every man throughout this age. But on Monday and Tuesday, he makes this point, and it's an all-important point. It's a point that our generation needs to hear as well as every other generation. And his point is this. The offer is genuine, but you don't take Jesus on your terms. You take him on his terms. You take him for what he is. You take him as the God of the world. You take him as your only hope of salvation. You don't take him on your terms. And when Jesus stood there and made that plain to the... And then you see, that's on Tuesday afternoon, and I would submit to you, and this is what we're going to talk about right now, that he left the city with about a day to think about that. 2 days, really, to think about that. Because let me tell you what's going to happen real quickly, just to make a point. Be one of the disciples for a minute. Pick the one you like best, okay? You're one of the disciples. You're one of the 12. Nobody's picking Judas. I don't blame you. But my point is, and Judas wouldn't work so well. But my point is, you're one of the disciples. You really believe. You're a follower. You've been doing miracles in his name. You've been preaching the gospel of the kingdom. And you're saying to yourself, okay, Jesus over the last 6 months has been talking rather repeatedly about this business of dying. I don't know what he's talking about. Doesn't make any sense to me. But are we on a roll or what? Right? When he showed up on Sunday, the whole city came out and threw their garments down. Doesn't look like death to me. On Monday and Tuesday, this one who claims to be Messiah did exactly what the Old Testament Messiah says he's going to do. He came suddenly to his temple. And he possessed that temple. And behaved himself more messianically, more publicly, in a public fashion, more messianically than ever else in his ministry. So here it is Tuesday afternoon. And by the way, whichever one of the disciples you decided to be, remember that you are in the happy possession of a remarkable promise. That you're going to sit, along with your 11 confederates, on 12 tribes, 12 thrones, over the 12 tribes. So when the kingdom gets here, I get to be one of the honchos, one of the top dogs. So the kingdom is even more inviting than it might be, right? So and again, as I said yesterday, this is Passover season. And Passover is the season of year which commemorates the time of the year when you specifically remember the time when God delivered Israel from a Gentile power. And let me just tell you something. I don't want to go back and rehearse that whole story, though it's certainly, you know, a story much worth rehearsing. But you go back and think through the Exodus narrative, and let me tell you something. There was nothing more totally unlikely than that Israel could be delivered from Egypt. Egypt was not only the strongest nation in the world, it was the strongest nation the world had ever known, and there was no second place nation. And Israel was a little... Did I say Israel? Did I say Egypt? Egypt was so strong, it was unspeakably... You know, you couldn't even imagine it. And yet... And Israel was nothing more but a slave people. And yet God knew how to deliver them. Well, now there's a nation even more powerful than Egypt. It's called Rome. And Rome is described in the Bible in Daniel 7 as an undescribable beast. Can you describe something as undescribable? I guess you can. It does. But... It says it's a beast that knows no parallel, with great iron jaw that devours its enemies and feet that claw the residue to pieces. That's exactly what Rome was. Exactly what Rome was. And the very thought, and Israel was going to try in a little while and be crushed and obliterated, not permanently, but as a nation, when they try to rebel against Rome. So my point is, you're one of those disciples. You're thinking, look what happened on Sunday. The whole nation accepted him as king. On Monday and Tuesday, he behaved himself messianically. This is Passover. As unthinkable as it is that we, Israel, could deliver ourselves from Rome, we're not going to do it ourselves. We're going to trust God. Why not happen right now? So my point is, I think the disciples are fully persuaded. I think they are probably absolutely giddy with anticipation of the kingdom actually being inaugurated. They're looking for it. And Jesus, meanwhile, is moving toward the cross. That make sense to you? This is Tuesday afternoon. On Tuesday evening, by the way, after this scene on the Temple Mount where Jesus had possessed the temple and then had spoken these woes upon the Pharisees, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you make clean the outside of the cup, the inside's filthy, you're like so many whited sepulchres and so on. You compass land and sea to make one proselyte when you get done. He's twofold more of the child of hell than he was in the first place, all that sort of thing. And then Jesus leaves. Of course, you have that poignant scene in Luke where as he leaves the temple, he sees the woman casting her two mites into the treasury and sees this contrast between the shallowness and the hypocrisy and the self-serving, the self-aggrandizing spirit of the Pharisees, you know, and this humble woman. But then Jesus goes back to Bethany on the way. His disciples comment about the wondrous city of Jerusalem, and Jesus speaks the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24 and 25. Then Jesus goes back to Bethany, where he is safe, by the way. And as I said, we already talked about this, and we're actually going to move on. But that evening, this is terribly important, Judas sneaks off to the Sanhedrin. Because you see, last Saturday night there was a feast in Bethany. And at that feast, in honor of Jesus, who had raised from the dead just weeks earlier, one of the most important citizens of Bethany, Lazarus, at that feast, a woman named Mary, Lazarus' sister, had anointed Jesus with oil. And she had done it lavishly. She had taken the whole flask of just terribly expensive oil and spilled it over his head and so on. And when she had done that, which was it would have taken the breath away, perhaps on two counts, both the fragrance and the generosity of the act, would have taken the breath away of everybody in the room, everybody in the place. But the point is, when she did that, Judas rebuked her. And when Judas rebuked Mary, Jesus rebuked Judas. And the way both Matthew and Mark, and then even Luke's comment in Luke 22:3 makes, the way they tell that story, it's quite clear. They want you to understand that it was that rebuke administered by Jesus to Judas on Saturday evening that settled itself deep in the unregenerate soul spirit of Judas and began to fester, and finally it exploded into action on Tuesday evening when he stole off to the Sanhedrinists and made a bargain. Maybe we'll do it. I should pick it up there. Luke 22:6. If you look at it real quickly. I said this yesterday, but it's so important where we're going, I better repeat it. Luke 22 tells about how Judas came. And by the way, the context is so instructive because it says that the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin, don't let these words trouble you, but the word Sanhedrin is just the more or less official word for that Jewish body of self-government. The Romans allowed the Jews and all the peoples over whom they ruled a certain measure, a significant measure of self-rule. And the body through whom that self-government was expressed, primarily, there were Sanhedrins all over the place. Every little village had a Sanhedrin. But the great Sanhedrin was in Jerusalem, and it was composed of 70 men. And it was ruled over by the high priest, a man by the name of Caiaphas. And we'll have occasion to talk about that this evening, actually. But what happens is that that Sanhedrin gathered, and on Tuesday evening, all right, now I've lost my way. The Sanhedrin gathers on Tuesday evening. They are mad beyond words. Number one, this is, forgive the illusion, it breaks down in just about a million points, but this is, after a fashion, near Christmas season in terms of raking in the dough. You know what I'm saying? This is Passover. Passover is the season when the temple authorities, Sadducees, who comprise about half of the Sanhedrin, make all this money, and Jesus ruined it for them. He tossed out their merchants and took control of their shop, you know what I'm saying? And said, you're not going to make this into a den of thieves. Plus, the Pharisees had just weeks earlier said, we want to arrest this man, and nobody is to make common cause with this man. And then he rode into town, and the whole city knew to welcome this king. So they're just beside themselves with rage, and they convene on Tuesday evening, and they say this. It's right there in Luke 22. We need to arrest this man, but not during the feast season, because we fear the people. All right, now I got to stop. Folks, and most of you know this because I talked about it, but I know there are many who haven't been able to witness, so I got to set some background here just at this level. When it says that the Sanhedrinists, the Jewish authorities, did not arrest Jesus because they feared the people, it wasn't that all the people were muscled up and carrying clubs. Okay, that's not the point at all. It's not that the people are going to retaliate immediately. But rather that this is the scenario that, as I said the other day, it is true that the Romans did not allow their subject peoples, whoever they were, to have any sort of arms, any sort of weaponry, any sort of military or police authority. Well, they might have authority, but they didn't have any actual force. They didn't have because if, in fact, the Sanhedrin wanted to arrest somebody, and this is exactly what's going to happen, we'll see it in a few minutes, if they wanted to arrest anybody, they had to go borrow some Roman soldiers. The Romans had a fortress to the north of the temple called the Fortress Antonia, and they would just go up there and borrow some of those Roman soldiers. That makes sense to you? Because the Romans did not allow their people, their subjects, to have military force or to execute people. And as I said the other day, that seems a little confusing to us, perhaps, because, you know, Stephen probably would have liked to remind them of that particular protocol. You know what I'm saying? And in other words, the point is that they grab Stephen and haul him off and stone him to death. Well, again, I go back to it. The Romans assigned officers to every one of the governing districts. The officer assigned to Judea and Samaria was a man, you know him, named Pontius Pilate. Every one of those officers had two basic responsibilities: collect the taxes and keep the peace. And if they couldn't keep the peace, if there were constantly riots and troubles and so on, then in fact, you would be replaced by somebody else. And so the point is this. This is where I'm taking you. That what the Sanhedrinists were... Oh, let me go back to Stephen. The reason that they could get away with taking Stephen off and stoning him was because Stephen was nobody. He didn't have a following. And so they could just... And Rome, sure, it might be illegal, but Pilate's trying to keep the peace around here. And so the Romans knew what it was, just to kind of, you know, just turn a blind eye and say, okay, do what you got to do. That was never the case with Jesus because of his popularity. That's so important. And this wild-eyed, it's what I call fascination. The nation was fascinated. He was the best show in town. Now, they didn't really believe him, and all Jesus has to do is make some spiritual demands. And they say, oh, you mean it's going to cost something? No, thanks. And they go home. But the fact is that everyone, and this is true until Tuesday of the Passion Week, Jesus, and it's certainly true during the Passion Week because he cleansed the temple. And when he cleansed the temple, everybody fell madly in love with him at that superficial, self-serving level. So what I'm saying is, the Sanhedrinist's calculation is this. And this is terribly important to what we're going to talk about the rest of the time. We might take a Stephen, a nobody, and just spear him off to haul him behind a house somewhere and stone him to death, and the Romans will, you know, wink at it. But if we do that to Jesus, there will be a riot. The people will not let us get away. And if there's a riot, the Romans are going to send troops, and they're going to want to find out who is the cause of this, and heads are going to roll. And it would be Sadducean heads, or Pharisee, it would be Sanhedrinist heads. Does that make sense to you? So I take it way back to Luke 22. It says there that the Sanhedrin gathers, and they determined to put Jesus to death, but they said not during the feast. Verse 2, they feared the people. And in this same place, Matthew says that the Sanhedrinist said, we need to put him to death, but not during the feast. Time out. Does everybody know Passover is a week-long celebration, right? So there are three feasts, actually. There's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and then there's the Feast of First Fruits, actually the other way around, and then there's the Feast of Passover. So you're in the midst of the weekly feast cycle, that is the week-long feast cycle called Passover right here. But the day of Passover has not yet arrived. But when they say we need to put him to death, but not during the feast, they mean not during this, not while this, all the people are here. We'll wait till all the people disperse, and then we'll put him to death. And yet, Jesus is in fact going to die on the Passover. How does that happen? Well, the answer is Judas, because in verse 3, Satan entered into Judas. And by the way, it's at that point right there that both Matthew 26 and Mark 14 place the flashback narrative of the anointing experience, as if to say that it was in fact the rebuke of Jesus that can be by Luke characterized as Satan entering into Judas. But anyway, Satan entered into Judas, and he went his way. This is Tuesday evening, and communed with the chief priests and captains. He went out to a hill south of Jerusalem. He'd been to Jerusalem, he'd been to Israel, because we always have fun with this. My political predisposition is going to manifest itself here just slightly, but because to this day, that hill where the house of Caiaphas was and where Judas went to make this bargain is called the Hill of Evil Counsel. Today, it's the headquarters of the UN. There's a big UN flag flying there, so you can always have fun when you say, there's the Hill of Evil Counsel. But nonetheless, the point is, he went his way, and look at verse 5. They were glad and covenanted to give him money, but I want you to see verse 6. He promised and sought opportunity to betray him unto them in the absence of the multitude. So on Tuesday night, Judas made a bargain to betray Jesus in the absence of the multitude. That was the Sanhedrinists' difficulty. Not that they couldn't recognize him. I said yesterday that a lot of people have the notion that he was hired to recognize him because, and you get that out of the narrative of the kiss. But the kiss, you know, when Judas said, goes out to arrest him, and they say, Jesus says, the one whom I kiss, he's the one. That kiss was not designed for the Sanhedrinists. They knew well who Jesus was. They had been contesting him for all of these months, and certainly this week, if never before, they had learned to recognize him. But the kiss was for the Roman soldiers. Judas was not hired to identify. He was hired to help them arrest Jesus in private. Because Jesus was so careful. He was wise as a serpent. And he was so careful never to allow himself to be in a place where the Sanhedrin knew where he was, and he wasn't surrounded by these masses of people. And that's how he carried himself. That's how he protected himself. I said yesterday that this wild-eyed popularity, as superficial as it was, and I think as heartbreaking as it undoubtedly was to Jesus, nonetheless, this superficial, wide-eyed popularity that was afforded Jesus did two things. Number one, it protected him from his enemies, and number two, it horribly confused his disciples, because all this talk about dying wasn't making any sense at all when the whole city seemed to be going after him. But having said all that, I'm about to get past review. Sorry about that. It's Tuesday evening. Judas has made this nefarious, wicked bargain. Let me take you to the next page of the notes, and I'm not going to follow the notes real carefully. I'm just kind of work my way through the narrative. But on that afternoon, in Luke 22, verse 7, if you'll go there with me, Jesus sends Peter and John. It says, then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed. Now, let me just say that the Passover lamb had to be submitted for inspection. You would come, and every family had to have its own lamb. And you would, in most cases, purchase the lamb. You know, obviously, it had to be a genuine sacrifice. You couldn't steal the lamb. It couldn't even be a gift. It had to be something for which you had paid a fair price. You could rear it raise it. You could raise it yourself, But most didn't, because you had traveled from afar. So you had to buy the lamb and have it inspected on the 10th of Nisan, Nisan being a month of the year. And then on the 14th of Nisan, what the Bible says explicitly, that on the 14th of Nisan, between the evenings. All right, now what does that mean? In Israel, Israel lies between the desert and the sea, the Arabian desert and the Mediterranean Sea. As a result, you have a very interesting phenomenon. Number one, it's a very hot climate. And now this is the spring of the year, so it's quite pleasant. But the point is, the sun comes up early and maintains a pretty stable intensity throughout the day. But what happens is that, you got Israel lying between the desert and the sea, right on the Mediterranean Sea. Here's a little science. You know, I'm telling you everything I know, and I'm making up a couple things here. But the fact is that as the sun beats and warms up that air, that hot air is going to rise, right? And the air over the earth is going to heat up more quickly than the air over the sea. So it's going to rise. And you get the point, is about the middle of the afternoon, you start to get this really, really delightful displacement where the cool, moist air begins to waft in. You live for that. You want to live on the hills. The rich people always lived up on the hills where you could catch those Mediterranean breezes. That's how you lived your day, because tend to be a hot climate. Jews, they would be up early in the morning and work with the sun. And then when the sun got to its apex mid-morning and it started to get really warm, you would break and you would stop in the middle of the day. And you would, you'd have your first meal of the actual light cycle. And then you would rest for a while and so on. Then when the sun began to get past its apex and you started to get those cool breezes, you'd go back to work in the fields or whatever. And you would work till the sun went down. Then you'd go in and you have your next meal. Well, the point is this, that when the sun gets past it, when you start to get those afternoon breezes around 3 in the afternoon, that's what in Israel is called the first evening. And then when the sun disappears, now in your most translations, if you look back in Leviticus and Exodus and the Passover regulations, it'll say that you slay the lamb in the twilight. But what it says literally in the Hebrew is between the evenings, because that evening when, you know, that makes sense to you, when it starts to cool up, and then when the sun actually disappears over the horizon, that's the second evening. So the point is that the lamb had to be slain between the evenings, and you had to take it to the temple, and the priest would slaughter the lamb, and then divide the lamb up in certain ways. You would be given a portion of it, and the refuse would be destroyed, and the blood would be sprinkled against the altar, and then you would take that part of the lamb home and prepare a meal. So the point is that it was the day when the Passover lamb, and by the way, the meal would be eaten indoors with the door closed and your feet shod. Remember that? This is all in remembrance of the Exodus experience. Remember, the first Passover is the night they ate the lamb and the blood was sprinkled on the doorpost and so on. The angel passed over. You remember that? So all of this is sort of after that pattern. But the point is that it was the day when the lamb was to be slain, verse 7. And Jesus, verse 8, sends Peter and John and says, go prepare the Passover. And they say, where do you desire that we prepare it? And he says, behold, when you enter the city, you're going to meet a man bearing a pitcher of water. Now, you remember this story. What's going on here, folks? All right, time out again here. I said the other night, I spent some time on this. Some of you, as I say, we're not able to be here, so let me just rehearse it very quickly, that I think it's very, very important to honor the genuineness of Jesus' humanity. And what that means is I think we need to come to grips, and it's a happy, I think it'll be a happy epiphany for you. I mean, I didn't mean to put too strong a term on it, but to me, it's a delight to realize that my Savior actually lived a life out very much like our own, because I think we tend to think of him, as I said the other night, as sort of God dressed up like man and really living on a plane entirely other than ours. Okay? And I've appealed to that a couple of times. And I'm setting you up because this one gets people upset with me sometimes. Now, I've been whining about people upset with me all week, haven't I? And I, you know, it's not, I'm not all that put upon. But honestly, people will react to this. What's going on here when Jesus says to Peter and John, go in, I want you to go prepare for the Passover. Now, that would mean, by the way, it would mean go take the lamb, have it slain, take that part of the lamb which is given to the worshiper to the place where we're going to worship, make sure that everything's ready in the house we're going to worship, and prepare the meal. Well, Jesus says to Peter and John, I want you to go prepare. And Peter and John say, good idea. Where? Where do you want us to do it? And Jesus says, you go into town, you're going to be a man carrying a pitcher of water. Right, now, don't be upset with me yet. But a lot of people get the notion that this was something, this was divine omniscience. That Peter and, you know, Jesus says, go prepare for the Passover. Peter and John, where do you want us to do it? Jesus, good point. Well, I'm getting something here. You're going to go into town, you're going to meet a man carrying a pitcher of water and so on. All right. Could that happen? Perhaps. Although, if you start to think about the dynamics of this story, it doesn't make much sense. What's this guy doing? Did God give some sort of an epiphany to the guy on the other end with a pitcher of water? My point is, I am persuaded that Jesus set this up. As a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons that I'm advantaged to have that Wednesday, because I think on Wednesday, Jesus probably went to his host, Lazarus, and said, I need somebody to do me a favor. I need one of your servants. And perhaps he said to one of his servants, I need you to go into town. There's a woman who owns a very nice home. She is a believer. She has often helped me. The woman's name, by the way, was Mary. She is the mother of John Mark. All right, now that's conjecture, but it's pretty solid conjecture that the home was, in fact, the home of Mary, the mother of John Mark. I could walk you through that another time. But the point is that I think Jesus says to one of these servants, and this is conjecture, but I'm absolutely convinced that he somehow arranged this. And he probably said, I need to ask permission to use the house. And if she's willing to do it, I need to have her dispatch one of her manservants down to a certain well, Siloam, and have a pitcher of water about such and such a time of day. And because my disciples will approach him and he can lead him to the place. Now, why is Jesus doing this, folks? Why would he do this? Can you tell me? Think about Tuesday night. Come on, talk to me. What's at stake here? Who's he keeping the place from? Well, from the Sanhedrin via Judas. Folks, if Judas had known where the place was, the soldiers would have been waiting. And Jesus would have missed out on that last Passover with his disciples. By the way, Do you recall that when he joined them in the upper room, he said to them, "You don't know with what longing I desired to keep this meal with you"? I think it's the reference to the very deliberate, wise as a serpent steps that he took to buy himself this evening. That makes sense to you? If Judas had known, then the soldiers would have been waiting. Jesus would not have kept that Passover. He would not have instituted the Lord's Supper. He would not have had the opportunity to deliver that marvelous upper room discourse, "Let not your heart be troubled." He would not have had opportunity, and the vine and the branches and so on, he would not have had opportunity to pray for his disciples and for you and me on that remarkable high priestly prayer on the side of the brook, the Valley Kidron. And he would not have had the time alone with his Father in Gethsemane. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, I'm persuaded. I'm getting a lot of, Stevie looks. But I think about it. I think Jesus understands. And let me tell you something. It's not that I'm offended by omniscience. I will give. I said the other night, there are times where where the Spirit directs the Son to access his omniscience. Seems to me that happened with regard to Judas's deal. Jesus seems to be, now he may have just been able to put two and two together if he knew that Judas stole away on Tuesday night, but I'm not offended by it. He clearly knew that what Judas was up to, and that very possible, but I don't think this is just omniscience that this man is going to carry a pitcher of water. I think this whole thing is set up. Does that make sense to you? And Jesus is very carefully buying himself, if you don't mind, that evening. Well, I'll go a little further here as we go. But at any rate, so let me just take you in the narrative. Judas, I'm sorry. And by the way, for just a minute, and this is perhaps a more melancholy thought experiment, but be Judas for a minute. You've made a deal. Now you've made a deal with the most powerful, ruthless men in the entire land, if not history of Israel, the Sanhedrin. That deal is, you're going to produce Jesus for him on Passover night. That's clear. Because remember what's going to happen. I said this yesterday, but 600 Roman soldiers, fully outfitted, John 18, says explicitly that a cohort showed up with lanterns, weapons, and armor. So you got a whole armed cohort who are waiting for your signal. They are ready. They are absolute at the ready to arrest this pretender Messiah, this pretender king named Jesus of Nazareth. But they don't know where he is. They're waiting for you to tell them. Then you've got the Sanhedrin, 70 men who are horribly ruthless, who are intent on trying him in the middle of the night. They're waiting for the signal that that we've captured him. But that can't happen until you, Judas, make it happen. And then you've got Pilate, who has been somehow induced to show up on the pavement. He's gonna move his whole judicial apparatus out on the patio at about 4:30 in the morning, so that you can have this trial. All of this is going to happen, and it doesn't happen accidentally. You see the point? You don't just knock on the door and say, "Hey, Pilate, can we have a few minutes at 4:30 in the morning?" This is all set up. Does that make sense to you? You're Judas. You got this whole thing ready to go, and Jesus has bested you once again. You don't know where it is. So it's Thursday afternoon. You've been asking around, "Hey, guys, you got any idea where?" "No, I don't know." "Oh, man, you know what idea?" And now it's Thursday afternoon, and Jesus says, "Come on, gentlemen, we're going into town." And so you, Judas, along with nine others, there are 10 of you, Peter and John has preceded you, are following Jesus, and you've got sweat rolling down the back of your neck, and you're thinking, "I got to figure out where this place is." And now you come to this upper room, and once you get in there, what are you thinking about? You're Judas. You're trying to get out of here so you can go get the Sanhedrinists. Let them know where this place is. Okay, well, let me take you. I've used up my time, but let me just real quickly. Let me. You know what? Let's just think for a moment about. All right, let's do this. Go to John 13. Let's just focus on this. Folks, you know what happens. They gather in the upper room. You know what? It's important. What's your son's name? Seth? Salvador. Would you come up here and help me? Are you bashful? You don't have to do anything very dramatic, okay? Folks, I want to deal. This is Salvador. You mind? Good.
We're just going to lay down here, okay?
I want us to dramatize a little bit for you. Face them and lay on your left elbow. Yeah, just like, no, up on your left elbow. There you go. There you go. Just like that. Up on your elbow. I want you to think about what, you see, when you think of the upper room, right away you think of that picture. You know, that ain't helping at all, okay? So you got to get that out of your head. 13 guys all on the far side of the table facing the artist, right? With high Tudor back chairs and individual place settings. That's not the way it happened. I want you to visualize the scene, and that's why Salva and I are going to kind of produce. There would have been a table here. It was a low table, about this high. It would have been three-sided, U-shaped, open on the end for a servant, if there were a servant available. You, around the outside, the perimeter, the outside of that U-shaped table, there would have been pillows. And those pillows were, that's where you would sit. You know, the Bible says in the Greek again and again, and no translation honors this because it just ties them in knots, says they reclined to eat. This is how you ate, especially a feast. This is actually how you ate day by day anyway. Because you would sit here and you could make yourself comfortable, however, and there would be individual loaves, and then the lamb would have been put into a stew or a paste almost, and it would be in bowls, and you would take and tear off and dip in that common bowl, and that's how you would eat. And there'd be other things as well. Now, this will help you on a couple of counts. Because while Jesus is at the table, and by the way, here's another thing. The arrangement was very important. The place of the master of the feast. The master of the feast always sat, if you're looking at the open end of the U-shaped, he always sat on the right, second from the end. And the closer you were to the master, the more honorific your place. Luke says that as they walked into the room, they were quarreling over who should be greatest in the kingdom. And that quarrel was probably sparked over the issue of who's going to sit where. And because the closer you are, now forgive me, Salvador, but let me be Jesus, okay? So I'm Jesus. Now let me ask you something. Who is this? This is John. Because John refers to himself one time as the disciple who leaned on Jesus' breast. Now, you know, and in the picture, you got John in the, you know, the famous, you got him kind of craning his neck to get, but that's not the point. If he wants to whisper to me, he would simply lean back. By the way, almost certainly, who's here? Judas. Because Jesus is going to hand him a sop. If you just got a, you know, you just wanted to hand a morsel to a neighbor and so on. But you normally, it would be very unusual to go around the table to do that. Peter is undoubtedly way over there. He probably was distracted, you know, and didn't move fast enough. And so he pouted and he's plopped himself down way over there. Because this is what's going to happen. While we are eating, Jesus is going to say, the hand of the one who is going to betray me is at the table. And the disciples are all going to say, who could it be? Who could it be? And Peter is going to make motion to John, ask him who it is. And I'm persuaded that John is going to lean back and privately say, you know, ask me who it is. And I'm going to say, although the record's not explicit, the only way I know how to make sense of it, probably Jesus said privately, it's the one to whom I give the sop. Because later on in the course of the meal, I'm going to turn and give a morsel to Judas. Now, that act of kindness, remember, Judas is sitting here with sweat rolling down the back of his neck trying to figure out, how can I get out of here? There are 600 soldiers who are going to arrest somebody tonight, and I'd sooner not be me, you know what I'm saying? So he's trying to figure out, I got to get out of here. And he has this hateful and this wicked designs in his mind, and Jesus just turns and does a neighborly kindness to him. And you know what the dynamic of sin is when you're harboring wickedness. And somebody does it, you know, and that just sends Judas over the edge. So he's going to get up and make a lame excuse about, I'm not going to stay here and I'm going to go stay at my house so I can be up in the morning because I need to go to market. I need to buy something against the feast. And Jesus is going to say, whatever you got to do, do quickly. Just go do it. And so Judas leaves. And when he leaves, there is this, according to John, there is this breath of relief in Jesus and so on. Does that make sense to you? The narrative? Because Judas is going to leave. By the way, you remember Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, you always read it in connection with when we take communion, but what he says actually in the Greek is, on the night while he was being betrayed, Jesus took bread. Now think about that. Judas had gone to get the Sanhedrinists,
And after he left, Jesus institutes what we remember as the Lord's Supper. So it was while he was being betrayed that Jesus took the bread. One other thing, and with this we're done. We're done in 2 minutes. Be patient with me. Why are we affecting this posture, Salvador? And he's enjoying it, isn't he? He paid good money for this posture. Jerusalem is, this Passover is in the spring of the year. Passover is during a season that biblically is called the latter rains. And it's a time when you get heavy rains in Jerusalem, in Israel, because of the weather pattern. As such, it's a very sloppy time, dirt streets and so on. And so one of the protocols by that culture was that you never entered a feast with soiled feet. And the Bible says that there was a basin there. But you see, the problem is there was no servant. It was a borrowed house. In most cases, a servant, and usually it wasn't something to be jealous for, so a lowly servant would be assigned the business of washing the worshiper or the guest's feet. But there is no servant. There's just a basin. And the reason I emphasize it is because if you think it in terms of the picture, your feet are tucked away under the table. They're not, see. We're sitting here at table. Our feet are hanging out for the world to see. They haven't been washed. Thanks, Salvador. I'm done with you. Thanks. Good man. Go to John 13 real quickly. John's the only one that records this for us. And I'm going to make one point and we're done. And then we'll pick it up in the morning service with the rest of the upper room experience. But John tells us this story of the feet washing because it says that as he had begun, and by the way, back up now because Judas is still in the room, and it's remarkable how John introduces this in the first part of the chapter, but I won't read it all to you. But it's just interesting that Jesus takes, and you know what? You got to think that there was a bit of a gut check for each of the disciples as he walked in the room. His feet are soiled. You know, they're wearing that long garment. He's looking at that basin and he's thinking, hold on here. I don't want to wash my own. I certainly don't want to wash anybody else's. You know, some of those tribes are bigger than others. You know what I'm saying? I don't want Gad or Dan. I'm hoping for Judah or Ephraim, you know. And so I don't want to be looking like a servant. And so I have the picture of these guys kind of, you know, trying to hide their sodden feet. You know what I'm saying? And now they get in, they're laying down, they got their feet are soiled, and Jesus gets up. And one by one he walked. And you know, when he comes to Peter, and by the way, imagine the scene. I mean, this is a dramatic scene for Jesus, the master. And not only the master of the 12, but this one who claims to be God come in the flesh. To get up, this one who claims to be Messiah, this one who is destined to sit in the throne over the entire universe, this one who verily called the universe into existence, now girds himself with a towel and one by one goes from person to person and washes his feet. And you remember Peter remonstrates and says, no, I can't let you do it. And Jesus says, just play along. I'm going to explain it to you in a minute. And Peter says, no, you can't do it. And Jesus says, if you don't let me wash your feet, you have no part with me. Okay, give me a bath, my head and my hand. And Jesus says, no, you're clean. Just need to have you. But then Jesus goes, and after washing the disciples' feet, he sits down. And let's just read this, and with this we're done. Because this is important, folks. And let me just say, I know I'm terribly over time, but real quickly, Jesus didn't have many minutes. And he knows he doesn't have many minutes. And yet this was so important to him that he took the time to perform this remarkable service and this remarkable object lesson, and then to drive it home this way. Because if you look in John 13 and verse 12, after he had washed their feet, he sat down and he said, do you understand what I've done to you? Verse 13, you call me Master and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. And then he says this, verse 14, and I want to read it kind of strange. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet. All right, now let me just stop there. Because I want to make a point. It's a skinny little point. Well, I think the point's important, but it's a silly way to do it. But let me just ask you a question. How do you finish that at your house? If I have washed your feet, now you finish that for me.
You wash mine.
You got to wash mine. Now, if Jesus were here today, would you be willing to wash his feet? My. I'd stand in a long line in the rain, wouldn't you? Jesus never asked us to wash his feet. He asked us to do something remarkably more challenging, and that is to wash one another's feet. That's what he said. And he goes on to say, and what he's talking about is living your life out to serve others. You know, three different times, Jesus made one of the most desperately Counterintuitive statements, counterintuitive to everything that our culture and our fallen nature tells us. Three different times he says, the man who would save his life is what? Going to lose it. You live your life out because you want to be served and you want to be happy, you're going to be miserable. But the man who gives his life away for my sake and the sake of the gospel, what? Going to find it. And that's exactly what he's saying here. And of course, here you have these disciples who think that, well, wait a minute, I want the big thrones. I want to be known as a leader. I don't want to look like a servant. And Jesus is saying, ho, the way you establish your bona fides as a leader for Christ is to give yourself away in service. And he says in this context later on, here is how men are going to know that you're my disciples. What? If you have love one for another. And that love is going to manifest itself in a desire to serve one another. It's a remarkable statement, especially against the backdrop of these disciples are so hungry for their chiefest places in the kingdom. Okay, we'll pick it up there in the morning service. Let's have a word of prayer. Thank you for your patience. I'm embarrassed. Our Father in heaven, again, we do thank you for this remarkable lesson. We thank you for the life that our Savior lived. We thank you for the death that he died. We thank you for the pattern that he left us, Father. And certainly when he girded himself with a towel and went from one of his disciples to the next, he displayed in a remarkable way a willingness to serve others. But Father, in an infinitely more blessed way, before the sun had set another time, he even more remarkably demonstrated his willingness to serve others. When he became death, he suffered death on our behalf. Father, we thank you for this one who, though he was rich, for our sakes became poor. We thank you for this one who put on display this remarkable willingness to give of himself. This one who came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. Father, we thank you for the life that is ours because of the death that he died. And I'd pray that it might be our desire to, by your Spirit, and in obedience to your command to live our lives out in following that pattern of selflessness. Thank you for it in Christ's name. Amen.